Could I have some of Mrs. Rajpali's special? That's what she wanted me to take. Yes. I'll have to take now.
Very nice.
We're dealing with social governance. Have we finished? Yes. Jane? Yeah. But before we do that, this first question that was impertinently asked and took you by surprise, have you been able to deal with that first question that Ms. Masumela asked?
Thank you, Chair. On the question of research work that we have done, we have done a few or commissioned a few research projects. I want to cite two or three of them and explain what these were about. The ones that I'm going to indicate to you are published research works by us. In 2002, to be precise, the report was published on the 26th of November 2002. We looked at the potential impact of supplementary voting on the South African elections. In this research, which was undertaken by the HSRC on our behalf, commissioned by us, we were looking at ways in which we can maintain and perhaps improve voter participation rates. Understanding what exactly concerns voters, what is it that we need to do to facilitate their participation in elections, and what projects do we need to conceive and implement. In 2005, part of the problem that we had identified at the time was the registration and participation of young people in our elections. We commissioned Millward Brown and associates who work extensively with young people or youth organizations, focus groups, research work, and so on and so forth. There we were particularly looking at what opportunities would best serve them as they prepare for registration, and how best we, where best we meet them or we find them for registration. It was also published, and perhaps this is the one that was the most useful in terms of getting or increasing our registration rates with young people. It was following this research and implementing the findings thereof. We have undertaken work almost every election with the Human Sciences Research Council. Often before, well before voting, to understand the expectations of the voters in terms of the election that we're going to hold, how they perceive our work, what they believe we need to do to facilitate voting, and so on and so forth. And also, once the elections have been held, to get feedback from them. And all of this research materials, we have published and we have copies of those reports in our offices. So I just really wanted to indicate those. There was a question asked about whether we have looked at electronic voting. Safe to say that we did look at it in 2002 when we were looking at the potential impact of supplementary voting on the South African elections. And we said that we possibly need to revisit that subject in 5 years' time. At the time, it was quite a number of issues were highlighted that broad issues of trust, reliability, access to electricity and things that were spoken about before. And we said we would relook into that kind of work in 5 years. I want to just stop there.
It's 4.6 million spent on research. Yeah, as a former academic, my mouth salivates at the idea of 4.6 million. Now, I know the Human Sciences Council is an expensive body, really. But 4.6 million is a lot for research when other people are doing a lot of associate research now. What do you spend 4.6 million on research?
Thank you, Chairperson. The 2006 one was particularly with elections very close on election day. I think it was the one that we were doing. We were looking at the satisfaction of voters, their experience in the elections, the kind of things that we needed to look at immediately following that election that we needed to do. One will notice that in that kind of research, the representativity of that sample is very important, and it happens on the day of that election because that's the only day that you will get somebody that has been to a voting station or who participated in voting on that day. And the extent to which that was done was, as the chair says, not very very cheap, if one could say that.
Yeah. Follow up on research. I just want to find out to get your views as onto the possibility of establishing your own research unit. And somewhere in your presentation, you referred to the Center for Elections Learning. Could you tell us more about what this center does and what would be the relationship between the center and the research unit? Then.
The Center for Elections Learning was established in 2005, primarily one of the things that it would increasingly look into is its research itself. There may be opportunities to collaborate with other research institutions, but primarily the kind of challenges that we face in the institution many of them would reside in that Center for Elections Learning. It is new. It is something that we are working on, and in terms of the organizational review, it's one of the areas that they have identified as an area that would need resources that we place in there and be able to undertake quite a number of research.
The Electoral Institute of South Africa, I know the Chief of Delivery has gone to Ireland of all places to work, but isn't there a possibility of developing relations with the Electoral Institute of South Africa, which concerns training and things like that?
We are very fascinated by the model we have seen from the Nigerians, and we are looking at it very closely, and whether in fact we should not work what the Nigerians do, which we think is interesting, but we need to look at it again. Their own department is attached to three universities, and so they train people right through the year through these particular faculties in their universities. And then in addition to that, it is those faculties that help in those universities with research, so that you don't have to then, as we do, farm out our own research to organizations. You can get the university to cooperate with us. That seemed to be something we might consider as we are discussing the reviewing of our own center or strengthening it, so that we can also keep the professional, intellectual approach as well at the same time with it, if we are able to utilize them. So we are definitely, this is one of the areas, as Msutu has said, we want to strengthen which is not our strongest.
No, but I said there's Medical Institute of South Africa, the NGO. Nigeria, of course, is 33 states.
36.
Very federal. One Yoruba University, one Hausa Fulani University, one Igbo University. But Panji, sorry, advocate.
No, we do work quite closely with AISA in some of the projects that we do. But on the Center for Elections Learning, it is operational. In fact, one of the innovative programs that we started for the 2006 elections was what we call e-learning, where our electoral officers could take a test on the computer on all the electoral steps and mechanisms. It's such an interesting, I went through it myself, you know, to just answer the questions and to say that if you got less than 90%, you couldn't progress to the next step. So e-learning is an innovation of our election center, which we think we can also share with our sister organizations on the continent.
Yeah, just on that very question, this e-learning, is it part of this center, and can people take lessons anywhere else in the country electronically? Is that what it means? Because I would imagine if people have got to go to a particular area, it may not be feasible all the time, particularly given the fact that people are from far-flung areas, etc.
Yes, they can do that. We're minimizing contact learning because it's very, very expensive, especially for electoral officers. If you have to bring them at one place to train them, that becomes very expensive. That is why we established the e-learning. It is available on desktop to all the officials.
Just one last on institutional government. We earlier on touched on our involvement in the international world. I just want to know as to how you balance the responsibilities that is locally with the development of the African and international relations. Thank you.
You're asking a difficult question. The only time we have had to think quite seriously about the balancing was the DRC, because we had never taken up such a big undertaking as South Africa to assist another country on that level. And that really was something where we had to sit and look at the staff team. But all this was after election. It was all after elections. So what did the CEO did? They looked at what was to be done after our elections and the processes that we follow and the timing we give to it. So then in the light of that, we could afford the certain staff to give more time to this particular project. This applies to Comoros is a little bit different. I mentioned the Comoros because it's a new experience for us. We found ourselves doing the Comoros entirely on our own with our self-defense defense, which was never the plan. We were asked to go and assist. And when our team got there, they realized that we had to bring more people of our staff. So we still have those very things that where we don't have a clear policy exactly in terms of that. But since the demands are getting more and more on us, on the international work, we are also looking at our Department on International Affairs, because the number of visits we get are also on the increase. The time we have to give to other people who come to South Africa is amazing, you know, just going through, to take them through. Sometimes they come, they spend a full week with us in Pretoria and take a bit of our time. We see as they do, and we take the others, spend 3 days and so on. And these are the things we never really structured and thought through in our international affairs department. But what I think we discussed with you, sir, with the foreign affairs, is one thing now we really have to look at how we work together. Because it's not in the plan. We sometimes just get a letter from foreign affairs saying, can you assist the such a country, you know, and then we want to support that because we are committed to working in the continent, which we limitations of time. But we always come first. I want to assure you that our country comes first. It's our priority. And we keep strictly to our time frames. We will not in any way change our time frames of our own work and plans because of the requests coming from outside.
Can I ask you this question again about institutional governance? You do not indicate page 35 whether mechanisms are in place to deal with conflict between the CEO and the commission or between the commissioners. These questions I ask everyone, so I don't want to be leaving you out of it. The CEO and the commission or between commissioners. Now, of course, allowing for the fact that the whole apostolic system rests on you and therefore you work with the kind of biblical unity, allowing for that, I mean, but we have to also answer this to Parliament as to whether you have sufficient instruments laid down, arrangements made down for conflicts. It's quite different from the earlier question about the division between the administration and the policy.
The one of conflicts
amongst the commission and
amongst us, yes. Fortunately we are a small group. It does help, I can assure you say that. If it's 5 persons, it's not like 12 people, and that's also based on the experience we've had of bigger commissions. And I think the number is very helpful. Second one is that the ones who are full time are 3 only, and I think rather than a larger number, which means with all the stresses of interference and hands-on approach, it's 3 people that the staff have to cope with. Amongst ourselves, no. We do disagree, which is very helpful on matters as commissioners. Sometimes we have different opinions on it, and we have developed the tradition over the years of reaching a consensus. And because we are a small group, it is easy for us to reach a consensus on many things. And I think it's important to add that the small group which we are, we all come from some kinds of backgrounds that help us to be able to mediate any tensions amongst ourselves and deal with them as individuals much more. We don't have to follow a formula of the law or disciplinary amongst ourselves. We have found a way of relating to each other.
That you decide things by consensus.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Between the commission and the CEO?
That's a very difficult one, especially with the CEO sitting next to me. Yes, I think we try. It's not always very, very easy because we all sit in the same commission meeting. And in the commission meeting, I think we operate differently. Everyone has a chance to speak. The CEO is there with us. And I think she tries, if I may say, CEO, to voice. She has equal access to us through the commission meeting for anything that comes from the staff team, anything that comes from the exco, anything that comes. She then brings what she wishes to bring to the commissioners for an open discussion. As you can well imagine, she has to battle on a number of things. If she brings the issues related to bonus for staff, big debates, issues related to performance appraisal, all those issues.
I'm thinking of, for example, section 82, subsection 5.
Which one?
Chief electoral officer must appoint in consultation with the commission. Presiding officers, voting officers, counting officers in each voting station.
Yes, that happens.
Now, how can the commission apply their minds and the law? You're nasty here. How can you do that? Because is there another area which lines between the commission and the chief executive officer are blurred, because the commission can't apply their minds. So scores of people have been appointed. So is this an area of some kind of blurring of functions then?
In consultation.
In law means in agreement. So presumably, these lists of people are part of the commission for the agreement.
Without agreements, we try to the best of our ability, and we have so many such examples of reaching those agreements. I would say this post is earmarked strictly for a woman, and we battle with it, and we get a male candidate. This might seem something very light, but with certain positions, as an example, the CEO will bring for senior staff, head team will bring to us as commissioners the final list. That is just as an example of people then shortlisted. And we debate those names with the CEO. At times we have unfortunately turned down the names reluctantly. She will agree with us. She will try to the best of her ability to convince us. We also try to the best of our ability to convince her. And then so on, things like that, the consultation does happen, especially on some difficult appointments that come on the senior staff in particular, not the other levels of staff.
Let me go back to the example that you've just posed. We have developed systems. We have electoral staff systems. At a policy level, the commission will take a decision that we will not appoint anyone who is not a registered voter as a electoral staff. So what we then do when we appoint the millions of people, the thousands of people who work in our voting stations, we apply the policy, we run the electoral staff system against the voters' roll system, and then we eliminate everybody who doesn't qualify. The law is clear, you can't be a candidate and you can't also be workers and electoral staff. So once we have a list of these people, we run our candidate nomination system against the electoral staff system. We eliminate all the people who don't qualify. We then take the names of all the people who have met all the requirements to the commission for approval, which is then appointment of these people in consultation with the chief electoral officer. So we deal with it at a systems level as well.
So in other words, in the end, there has to be a decision taken. The same consultation means that someone has to have the prior decision or the post decision. Anything else on this?
Chair, I may have missed this, but do you have a code of conduct? For both the commissioner and staff.
Yeah, you have.
Yes, in our for commissioners, sorry to laugh about this, because when we joined, we had a consulting company that prepared code of conduct for us. And amongst other things, they said no drinking during office hours.
No drinking what? That's another thing.
We mustn't fight amongst ourselves, all kinds of things. So that's why I was laughing. Of course, those were modified. And we have those that are much more with more substance. And I think that the CEO should speak for her team.
Yes, we do have a code of conduct for them.
Thank you, Chairperson, and hello to all our presenters here. Just on the voters' roll, we seem to be having problem in all election at the station in respect of people being turned away. And how have we in your department improved on the voters' roll? I hope the coming election we don't have the same problem. Otherwise, we have to be running around taking people from here to there all over. And of course, they are registered different place and they go on to thinking they are on the other voters roll. Thank you very much.
Chairperson, I think the biggest problem in this particular respect is people, and I'm talking about the staff, the people that conduct the election, their ability to follow an alphabet. It's amazing how generally people struggle with that. What we've done though, and then you also find it on issues such as a person gets married and the surname changes and the name on the register is still in the one surname and in effect the ID is already in another name, is that we now load the voter's roll for a particular voting district on the registration scanner. And a person just gives the ID and it then identifies as number 633, page 18. So that we guide them to where to go and find it on the physical roll.
Mm.
And that seems to be solving not every single problem. Those who arrive at a place where they're not registered still need to go to where they are registered. But by and large, I think 75% of problems seems to be going away with the use of the so-called zip machine and the roll on it.
Thank you, Chair. This is in connection with the code of conduct. Was it necessary to act against staff members or commissioners, ma'am?
You saw an annual report, by the way. There's some reference to some of fiscal shenanigans. There were two examples. Yes, would you like to answer?
Yes, we did take action against because the PFMA requires us to do that. The amount looks insignificant, it's 700 rand, but we felt that we needed to take action to lay criminal charges and to recover that amount because the law requires us to do it.
Before we move on to interaction with the public, can I ask you this, because I ask this everyone. You have extracts from relevant legislation in conflict interests and disclosure. But the issue is a much larger one, and that is commissioners may have to seek authorization from the president if they wish to have any. I mean, remember the commissioners are paid not badly actually, but yeah, it's like more than ministers are paid, so. Full-time ones. The others will get peanuts. The permission of the president, can you tell us where does one find out if permission has been sought by the commissioners for external interest, company directors or large shareholders? No. Where does one find out that? Because for the officials, you keep them there. Now, if on page 43, you said one of the functions of the commission, 43 of the annual report, is small business development, Black Economic Development Review, awarded 441 contracts, of which 339 went to VE company, approximately 60 million. How does one find out, which are reported the judges, for example? Judges may report their holdings. How does one find out if I'm an advocate appearing before a court? And that judge has an interest in some level and should be disqualified from hearing the case. How does one find out if the contract has been entered into fairly openly and the official entering the contract does not have interest in one of these companies which got contracts of 60 million? So, three-part question. Disclose the interests of officials, register is kept somewhere. Then secondly, how does the register work in relation to, and I speak of the former minister, because there were conflict of interest of an official who entered the contract. How do you establish whether there's a conflict of interest between the official who enters in the contract, but who has an interest in one of the companies, and 60 million, that's a fair amount, I mean, I could retire on 60 million. Then for commissioners have to disclose their interest somewhere in the register, but the Act says they must get permission from the President for activities of outside their normal role. Where does one find out when the President has given permission? So, think about the question.
On the one of the commissioners, we in the years we have been there, we have never really asked for a written permission from the president. What we do is that we disclose in the register, in our office as commissioners. And we have never had an experience of undertaking a responsibility. Normally we turn it down for things like the United Nations will write and say they wish to appoint you to do particular work for them and give you remuneration for it. Our experience in the years is that for things of that nature, we simply turn them down because we realize that it will be almost impossible for us to do. If people write to us and say, come and give a series of lectures for a period of a month, which has been done before, those requests coming from us. Those are the things, without even going to the president ourselves, we've had to turn down. It is only with the serving here in South Africa on the various boards that we make the decisions ourselves. We don't ask and write to the president for those kinds of things. But we do keep a record of
Section 9 of the Act says, if appointed in a full-time capacity, serve as such an exclusion of any other duty obligation arising out of any other employment, well, that's fair enough, or occupation, or the holding of any other office, unless specifically authorized thereto by the president, and the director of a company is in office. It's very clear. And we need clarification.
I think on that, Mr. Chairman, we have probably defaulted because of the new requests that have come to us to serve on companies. It really was never there before, I have to say. But now with the new invention of the BEEs and the requests that sometimes come for us, we have agreed to serve on those companies. But there is no written permission for most of us. That comes from the president for that.
Because conflict of interest can arise.
Really. Yes.
You know, if they, in fact, between ICT and other contracts, we dispose of a fair amount of money. And therefore, you know, I mean, the commission will discuss this, but I've suggested that one of the things we look at the committee is that all these issues should be in the annual reports. This is, you know, we'll discuss it ourselves, but I feel myself that disclosure has to be public disclosure. What's the point of treating like a Catholic in a confessional disclosure? I mean, the priest is not allowed to disclose anything like that, but disclosure. And also, of course, the disclosure by staff must not be in the human resource development area. I don't understand what human resource development is, by the way, but it should be the chief executive. The chief executive must keep a register of all interests. You see, the civil servant is kept by the Public Service Commission. The minister countersigns each year and goes to the Public Service Commission. Now, effectively, if under freedom of information legislation, there's absolutely no reason why under freedom of information legislation that information shouldn't be available. Huh? Absolutely no bar. There's no exemption. It's not a privacy matter. And so, therefore, this is why we're going to look at freedom of information legislation very carefully. But in many of the Chapter 9 bodies, the information is totally inaccessible as to what are the external interests of officials. Because, you see, in a democracy, those democrats who are making the system work must be open in the commercial links. You see? It's an essential part of democracy. And that is why, when we discuss this in the committee, the issue will arise to who keeps the register. And in the end, if, of course, can't be like members of parliament, IDASA publishes every year, you know, it's rooted abroad, quite rightly. But for Chapter 9 bodies, it must be with the chief executive officer. So that in the freedom of information legislation, everybody wants to know, is there a conflict of interest? You get the information. and it must be updated every year too. It's not very clear from the submission as to whether it's updated every year. Now, as for commissioners, well, this must be in the public domain. If you serve as commissioners, all your interests must be in the public domain. So there should be a register of interests vested in the chief executive officer, a register of interests like very much like parliamentarians have, and the executive has to, a register of interests. And then secondly, if in fact you hold any office, like a director, then you have to get permission of the president, it's very clear. But the register of interests will say what shares you have in different companies, which we have to disclose, you see. So, again, this is to assist, you know, openness and transparency. So you might have a look at it again, of course we have not come to any conclusions on that, but it is a good, for a body that's the heart of democracy, principles of openness and supply.
They can look at the forms we use in Parliament.
Yeah, no, that's no problem. I don't see why you have to get outside this right code of conduct for you. There are enough codes of conduct. I mean, for example, I just chaired this wine council. I took a declaration, a simple one-page declaration of interest, because I don't have any interest in the wine industry, one page. But then everyone sitting in front of me has one form of interest or another in the wine industry. And they must detail every bit of the interest. And that's four pages. But for someone like me, it's one page. I declare, I got a free weekend with one winery once. But otherwise, I don't have any interest in the wine industry. So we can give you the information, and the forms are easily available. But Mr. Mohammed will give you the forms here. And they're very simple forms too. Mm. So a good thing you raised this, because the committee will discuss this and come to a fairly quick conclusion about disclosure of interest. Thank you very much. Now, interaction of the public, Jane.
Thank you, Chair. We note that the amount of work that the Commission is doing to make sure that all communities are informed about elections, the processes, etc., especially, you know, the special focus groups like the rural voters, voters in informal settlements, women, farm workers, and youth. But the number of voters seem to be declining every election. Or can we attribute that to the African spirit, refer to the African model? The African model?
I think the question of declining voter participation is not a phenomenon isolated to us. What happens with democracy is that when countries experience democracy for the first time, everybody participates, even those that don't qualify want to participate. But as and when democracy matures, you do find that there are declining numbers. That is why in the kind of interventions that the Commission has undertaken, particularly with youth, with people, special interest groups, people on farms, and so on and so forth, the Commission has looked at where are the potential areas of improvement via research and our debriefing sessions with these communities to go and do more work in those areas. It is not necessarily that opportunities are not made available to people. It is because, I guess, people get to a point where they say, it's a given, we settle, things will work. But we are concerned about that, and we don't take it for granted. We make an effort to mitigate the declining interest.
Can we just complete that, because we have looked at the efficiency of the temporary bodies. I know that you answered my question, that the drive you have 2 or 3 weeks beforehand gets you people. But as part of the interest in elections, should we have 2 or 3 times a year, particularly on radio, asking people to register, ask questions, why to register? Have you changed your address? Have you changed your... Why shouldn't we have and you spend 4.6 million research, I mean, 4.6 million will go a long way in your budget for radio broadcast, but 2-3 times a year, just a consciousness driving, raise consciousness. We threw this out because it's so important that people should be not only aware. You see, politicians don't like citizens to be actively involved by and large. Now, for democracy, you want people to be actively involved. Now, one of the things is, in fact, to say, your vote is so important. Are you registered? You know, 2 or 3 times a year. So the radio is the one that gets to most people, right? And, you know, there's a system where you can speak to 24 of the indigenous languages of radio in one swoop, right? Which this committee has done. So you throw this out, that consciousness raising is a permanent matter, not a four-year, every 4 years thing. Jane?
In terms of complaints received from the public, do you conduct follow-up to ensure that the issues raised have been resolved?
Complaints to my notes, sir.
Oh yes, I think maybe this should be answered by operational people, because most complaints we receive are related to operations and coming from political parties. No,
they're not political parties, one, there's process for that. These are individuals writing to you. Plain John Macassini writes to you and says, excuse me, I was robbed of my vote. Do you get complaints at that time?
Especially after the election. We get a lot of those, many of them. We also get complaints from, especially this last time, we had a lot of complaints from independent candidates on all kinds of problems which they were facing, because some of them had never been candidates before. Some people actually come to our offices in Victoria, and we try to explain, respond, to the best of our ability. But the one that is more helpful to us, which will be referred to later, is mostly from our political parties as it relates to complaints and objections they raise. I think that process is much more systematized than the one of the public. The public people normally do it through letters, receive letters, and they go a lot to some of our provincial offices to lodge their complaints. If somebody is based here in the Western Province, their complaints are not necessarily sent to Pretoria. They will come to the provincial electoral officer, like in the case of our colleague who is sitting at the very end there, Courtney. The complaints will come from the people of this province and go to his office, and we handle them all together.
It'd be a good idea, Richard, because if in fact numbers of complaints, informal complaints, were reported in annual reports, and whether there's an increase from the previous year, for example. Just figures. Some of them could be broken down. There's one commission breaks them down, complaints about this, this and that. But it'd be useful to have that. Then arising from that is, which question we must ask you, what is the exact relationship between the head office through the chief electoral officer and the 9 provincial? What's exactly? What is the line of authority and function? What is the issue? How does it arise about information, statistics, keeping of statistics? And ultimately, the ultimate authority over the provinces. And the budgeting also. Because this question we ask everyone, I guess surprising answer.
We have 9 provincial electoral officers. All of them report directly to the chief electoral officer. They submit monthly reports to the chief electoral officer. And the reports are also details about the implementation of the project through the project tracker system, and also on the budget itself. Whether they have utilized, whether they are within budget, whether they are under expenditure, they report all those issues. And the CEO also evaluates their performance through our performance evaluation system. The budgeting process is, while we have budgetary allocations per province, we allocate our budget also per project, which means that for delimitation and voter registration, we will have a budget for that project, and it will then be divided among the provinces. The system seems to be working, but I think there is room for improvement.
Thank you very much for that. Thank you for the financial and resource management. Yes.
Chairperson, I think you have raised a very important question in respect of, I'll go back to voter education. Chairperson, it is so important that you are right that this should be done on a yearly basis, not coming closer to the election. I think also we should suggest that the local free newspapers be used in various areas, and such as pamphlets be issued in the rural areas as well, and shops and supermarkets and all these places should be actually worked together in respect of where people could be actually being educated and getting something in writing to say that what they have to do, and it should be going continuously, but various avenues should be explored. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. The HSRC prepared a very useful report for you with regard to voter trends, etc. And they are saying here with regard to possession of green barcoded IDs that 96.3% of the people who were asked whether they had these IDs indicated that they had them. Only 3.7% said they do not. And further on, you know, those people that were surveyed indicated or cited reasons like non-affordability or inaccessibility for them to get these IDs with regard to home affairs, services, etc. Do you share this, that is now on behalf of the people, information with home affairs? Because with natural attrition, some people dying, etc., there will indeed be people, new voters that register, so that you get a fair assessment of exactly how many people are registering between elections. I don't know if my question is clear.
I attempt to answer part of it, and then Norman will answer. Yes, we do share that information with Home Affairs. Their initiative of providing free IDs to people come about as a result of that kind of work. We work with them closely towards an election, for that matter. We wherever they issue IDs, we also register people. Second part of your question, Norman.
Now, we do offer a continuous registration facility at all of the municipal levels. I must say to you that the rate at which people register is not great. We have something in the range of 5,000-6,000 a month countrywide that would register. The death rate at this stage is in the order of about 40,000 a month, so we have a net loss of 30,000-35,000 on the voters roll until you have your next occasion. We have previously tried outside of an election period, campaigns, a newspaper campaign to get people registered, with not great results. What we've not done is the systematic 2-3 times a year where it starts getting a rhythm. We've not had funding, but we haven't had funds to that extent available, but it is something that one could look at, as the chairperson suggested.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Can we move then to financial matters? Oh. Okay, on finances, I have just one question for the IEC. I realize that you have got a direct link with the treasurer. which is not the case with most of the commissioners, and what recommendations would you make? Would you make regarding the other institutions, commissions that find themselves in this?
The other chapter 9 institutions. Tell us in detail your arrangements about budgets. We'll draw our own conclusions. Tell us from the beginning. Provinces make your claims, project government. Please tell us, how do you arrange your budget? How do you negotiate a budget? And then it appears as a heading on the Home Affairs. Thank you.
I just want, before my colleague answers the question, to say this has been a great history, and if there's time, I'm sure you listen to it, because it wasn't automatic for us to get that. As you have read the case, this went to court, so it's a long story. But I'll give my opinion also on it at a later time. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The first part of the question is how the budgeting process works. As the CEO has indicated, we have a project charter system. Each department head puts up a project, and then the project is costed. And then all these are paid departments, and then these go to the CEO for evaluation and so on. Then once that happens, that of course includes provinces, particularly for administration expenditure. When that has been evaluated, it goes to the commission for approval. Once the approval has been commissioned, has been obtained from the commission, then the whole budget is taken to the treasury.
But I didn't say half past 12, but Mr. Fadabraba has to leave past half past 12. But we are flexible in that, right? The secretary takes notes. So goodbye. We'll see you on Friday then. Thank you very much. I know. Well, you haven't come to the really interesting bits now. We've got a couple of months.
Chair, so once the commission has approved of the budget, of course we're talking about the 3-year budget in terms of the MTA. That gets taken by us to the treasury. And there's a constant interaction between the treasury and us. And with recommendations are made, agreements are arrived at, some proposals are kicked out the window and so on. And then that goes to through the normal budgeting process for the whole all of the government departments. The response to the last question is the proposal would be for the other chapter 9 institutions too, like us. Because the support of the Home Department is not as effective as they would have liked it to be. That's our experience. That's why we were directed to the Treasury.
Yes, well, I'm sorry to confuse you. The Treasury now says that they shouldn't be Home Departments, but Parliament should fix budgets. Now, does that mean Parliament as Parliament, or Parliament through a committee, or Parliament following your approach, direct one negotiation with that?
Direct negotiation works for us.
It's Parliament.
It's, yes.
Yeah, that's okay. Thank you. Yes.
Thank you. The great saga of the court judgment and your budgeting history is something that has kept one's hopes going through a few years, and I frequently invoked Judge Longo's dicta in that judgment in respect of other institutions. But now, since you have now evolved as a result of court cases and so forth, this excellent relationship with other bodies, I'm puzzled by one thing I want to ask you about. You have set out in, what did you call it, your document called the Electoral Commission and the National Legislature and the Executive. It's kind of a protocol on your relationship with the Executive. It doesn't have a title, but it's a kind of a statement of principle, isn't it? And in it you say wonderful, stirring things which I just hope already could apply to the others, such as neither Home Affairs nor any other State Department will attempt to prescribe to the Commission in the performance of its function. The Commission is not a line function of any State Department. Wonderful. Based on the authority of Judge Mother. And yet in the same document, now just over the page at 3, of the document called the Electoral Commission and the National Legislature, you've compiled it here just before the judgment, I think it was. It's in the back of your book. Thank you. At 3-4 and at page 3. Now there, notwithstanding the fact that you yourself appear to have reminded as of the Langeberg judgment, which says you're not an organ of state, you yourselves here, and also on page 53 of your submission, you say that you will pursue a cooperative and supporting relationship with independent state institutions, but also in respect of government. Now, it's fine as far as it goes, but you then cite precisely the principles on cooperative governance from the Constitution. In other words, you must foster friendly relations, avoid legal proceedings against each other, and so forth. Whereas I thought we had now a common understanding amongst us that not being an urbanist state, you were not subject to the principles of cooperative governance. Yet here you are yourself citing them in what is otherwise to me an absolutely stirring document.
Yes, that's 44.4, they provide appropriate guidelines also. This is a guidelines, not as what they said in the Stilby case, a binding necessity that you couldn't change the number of whatever it was without this. It's guidelines. It doesn't seem to be particularly irksome.
Chairperson, now this must have been seen in the context of the whole chapter. What we were trying to say here is that although we are independent, the legislature is independent from the executive and they are all independent from the judiciary. So we have in our constitution come up with this bright idea of creating other independent state institutions, constitutional institutions, which are these Chapter 9 institutions. Although we are independent from each other and cannot be influenced irregularly by each other, we also serve under the same constitution, and for therefore we should support each other in the governance of the country and in the interest of the country. And in that sense, we should, for instance, when we act internationally, we should do that in consultation with the government, consultation with the Department of Foreign Affairs, so that we do not transgress the international policy of the government and of the Department of Foreign Affairs. So the same way that the courts do that, if there is an international dispute or conflict between the government of South Africa and another country or another instance in another country, it comes before our courts. They will always take notice of the government's international policy, and they will act according to that policy. In that sense, we must all work together and support each other, although we are independent of each other.
Thank you very much. Yeah, well, you said it too. There are different views about how public bodies should exist, you know, and the whole idea of cooperation is quite different from cooperative governance. That's a binding stricture, that is that. Now, can I ask you some very tough questions? You claim that you've managed to contain growth in your budget over the last 6 years. Costs in real terms have dropped, page 20. Yet your annual report states expenditure increased from 251 million in 2001 to 923 million in 2006. How do you explain that?
Chair, thank you. Before we answer the question, we need to be aware of the cyclical nature of our operations and therefore our budget. So when we make comparisons, we ought to make comparisons of an equivalent year, the budget of the equivalent year to that is reflected, that we're talking about. But if you do that comparison, you will notice that in real terms, our budget is an expense are going down.
Well, I'll have to ask my economist friend on that. I'm a layman in this. Next one. You receive sponsorship is worth 3.4 million in 2006 to 700,000. The reception of sponsorship will impact on your need to be independent. Who sponsored the IEC?
We have international donor agencies sponsoring us, particularly just on voter education, because we have taken a conscious policy decision that we will not let them sponsor our operation. We have commercial sponsors as well for the results center. What happens at the results center when we have an election, companies buy space. You know, next to the leaderboard, you'll have Standard Bank, you know, buying space. It's advertising space because, you know, when we have an election, results are beamed throughout on television, and they buy space for what they would never. They get space for cheap space, actually, because if they were, yes, so those are the donations that we
do. You're supposedly involved. It's not, you're not a rugby club. You're not doing very well. The cricket one would be much better than the president showed the other day. What a good idea to have your central democratic event sponsored commercially. Is it a good idea? I'll leave it to you. Next question. In 2005, you spent 10 million rand computer equipment software. 2006, just more 10 million rand computer equipment software. At 5,000 rands per PC would buy 2,000 PCs a year. Who uses all the equipment? Are you too technologically involved for developmental stuff?
The equipment, each staff member at the three levels of our operations all have a PC, national, provincial, and all the our municipal electoral office, because in our business, if you can't use a computer, you will never survive. So we, in 2003, I think we changed our hardware because it was 5 years old. And I think we also have to say that with the introduction of the new software that Bill Gates is talking about, we'll have to change both our software and hard drive, because and hardware, because you cannot use that software on the computers that we have now. So it looks like we're going to have to change our computers again next year. Mm-hmm. That's a huge cost.
What do you mean when you say Bill Gates? You're obviously then not talking open source.
Microsoft.
The next generation Microsoft.
Yeah.
Is open source not any?
It's called Vista.
Vista.
The new generation.
Is open source not any kind of a proposition for you? And it's an idle question. I mean, it's a nice idea, but I mean, the mind boggles at the idea of changing all your systems, even to Vista.
Yeah, open source was not an option at the time that we established, and we've developed so many homegrown systems that is in a particular medium, and we're going to redo them in open source is going to cost you more than what it is going to be to replace hardware and software. It's not an economic question at this stage.
Is this now a blend of open source and Microsoft proprietary systems. I don't understand that, because if you go Microsoft with proprietary, and if it's open source, then it's, you know, homegrown. So which is which?
It's micromanagement now. Thank you very much. It's not of interest to us.
No, we're not in the open source.
Oh, okay.
Not at all.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's micromanagement. That's your... You're too technologically invested. That's why I asked the question. You're middle class, bourgeois, technologically invested, not looking at workers' interests. That's why I asked the question. We move on. Very important thing. You spent $216 million in fees by the institutions for services. Is that true? $216 million fees by the institutions services and ended in 2006. $109 million in 2005. Are these figures correct? Now, why is so much money spent on consultants? Is $216 million correct? Well, that's in 2006. That would be nearly a quarter of your budget. Quarter of your budget. Now, I know the Public Service Commission carried an investigation on consultants, but $216 million. And consultants. Is there value added? What value is added to? And so how would, in fact, it's gone up from 109 million, 2005 to 260 million. So is that correct?
It is correct. 2006 was an election year. So because it is an election year, we, as I indicated, we are a small organization, we expand, and we use a lot of consultants, particularly in IT and in finance, to assist us in preparations for elections. I mean, finance, for instance, if we have to pay all the 250,000 election staff that we use, you know, we have to pull in consultants to assist us with that, to clean up the books and the records. And IT as well, because we have a small IT department. When we have an election, we then use consultants. We use VSET also, and part of that money was used for that.
In fact, it might be useful to break it down from the public, because as it stands now, it's like government departments, you know. When they can't get an answer to a ministerial question, they get a consultant who has no value to the department, again, ever. So it might be useful if you should break it down, but most of the money was for payment and for running the election, and then some of it for IT. And what will you do without television, without all those IT people around?
Yes.
Why
105 million?
It was registration. Remember, we had the two registration weekends in 2005, I think September and in November. Three of them, actually.
Things like newspaper advertisements, payment for the registration clerks. Yeah. Now, next question. According to the annual report, you spent $640,000. On remunerative allowances. $4.8 million on gratuities in 2006. We have to ask this question. Are these bonuses or what? And if you say in your annual report that benefits the commissioners, are these part-time people or benefits to full-time people? So, there are three questions there.
Chair, the $641,000 is for overtime payment for permanent and temporary staff. The gratuities that also for $2 million for permanent staff and the MAO agents, basically, mostly sleep, when people leave, then we pay the leave credit that's due to them.
Allowances in the report 2006. What are the allowances? $374,000.
What page of the annual?
23. The amount of matter is just, we have to ask this question, everyone.
And the part of the allowances we're talking about there is in when we have elections, sometimes we do relocate people temporarily into areas of need where they would be deployed there and work there. And in that instance where we move people from their normal workstations to those areas where we need them the most, we would look after them and pay them allowances to keep them there and until they come back. That's the limit. Yes.
And benefits says in brackets, commission. Sorry for recording. We're recording now. Yes, page 23 says benefits in brackets, commissioners. $906,000.
If you look at the salary structure of the commissioners, they have the basic salary, which is that of a judge, and benefits, which are benefits of a DG. And that is what that is about.
A few things have really gone right with the electoral. If you think of section 219 of the Constitution, which says, you know, a framework has to be set up to look at the salaries of judges and all of the independent commissions. And here that has happened now via another channel directly with the President, but the comparison is correct, in my view, that your benchmark should be the judges, and then you work from there. And it's interesting to me, I'm not sure why that happened correctly. It's as a result clearly of the judgment that many of your budgeting processes are working correctly. I think your appointment mechanism is the one we should follow for others, but that's for another day.
Yes. That is always for another day too. We're just seeking clarification. Because there's such a great divergence, which is causing enormous problems, judge and nine bodies. That's the problem, right? And the divergencies are, in the end, subversive. Right? Everybody, I mean, I remember, which I won't mention, but Advocate Pansy will know, Chief Advocate of One Body, brought a matter to the Cabinet, by the way, in 1996, to say his salary is totally out of line, you know. Yeah. And he got his way. As he got his way elsewhere, too. But, that's bad. So,
also in our case, which is very different, is that the people who actually interview us, except for the chairperson of the panel, are our own colleagues from other Chapter 9 institutions. So there is it's fine. The Constitutional Court judge is the presiding officer, but our colleagues then are the ones who...
No, that's true. I won't say which member of the committee felt that was a very good system, but this is one of the things we look at. How do you have, apart from the Constitutional Court judge itself, it's very difficult, by the way, because, you know, if you're going to suggest that for other bodies, then the Constitutional Court won't have a Chief Justice to look after it. But the idea of your peer looking appointing you is something we have to look at. Right? It's always stuck with. But remember, this was the first flight of enthusiasm
in 1996. We did lots of things. Why did we put 11 bodies into the constitution?
Interesting. Do you know how that happened? We had submission. One of the wonderful things we've created in this, under this constitution is the process of transparent submissions by the public and interested parties. We had a submission from an NGO suggesting that within the constitutional requirement for the appointment of Chapter 9 bodies, you know, the proportional committee of Parliament recommending to Parliament, that we they introduce before the man's come to Parliament the appointment, the interviewing panel that you've just described. And it was a proposal from Ms. Leanne Delahunt, if memory serves, which we took up and put in the law, and it has worked from that day on, as far as I can see. And this was early, your very first law, the Electoral Commission Act. It was a proposal from an NGO, and it seems to me you just introduce an extra layer without disturbing what the constitutional 194 says.
What they're raising the point is, can you have a representative, not necessarily the chief executive of a Chapter 9 body, because it says, oh, he's or her representative, sitting, but you see, you're the first one to raise it with us, which is a good idea, so we notice that they. Whether that's right or not, we'll discuss that. But thank you for raising it. Any further question? We exceed half. We'll release ourselves in a moment, and this person will release himself to his bed. We have had a long session. But thank you very much. It has been very stimulating, and quite clearly our body language varies from one body to another, one condition to another, depending on the degree of frankness which you face. And you've been very frank, because one or two questions have been near the bone. But that's our job, Father. Now, some of the questions have been micromanagement questions, which you don't have to be perturbed about. It's not our function to be really looking at how much you spend on broadband, or you spend on this kind of computer or that. But the basic thing was that, now, if in fact you'd like to add anything to what you're submitting, we have drawn your attention to the fact that you need a legal basis for everything you're doing. The Auditor General obviously hasn't got around to that yet, but we need to do that to strengthen you. The important thing is that, unlike some of the bodies we look at, this body has worked to serve democracy. That's important. So if we put you through the ringer, it's largely to say we can report to Parliament that these are the areas that need strengthening. These are the areas where they need fortification. These are the areas where they maybe need for statutory change. Otherwise, we want you to believe that Parliament or democratic order invests so much hope and aspiration in the work of the in the work of the Electoral Commission. Thank you very much, and this session is now closed, and on Friday, of course, we'll look at the Gender Equality Commission. Thank you very much.
Highly technology.
Ribbitment of children, digital network.
Yeah, he's a young man, he must.
I'm not a unicorn, yeah.